And
I'm going to call this joint meeting to order. We are having a combination of both the Senate and the House pulled together for our of the HES committees together to hear about bringing the kids home. And I'd like the record to show that it is about 1:36 and on February 15th, 2008, and Senator Davis and I are co-chair, or at least chairman of our respective committees. And let the record show that Senators Davis, Senator Thomas, and Senator Elton are here. Myself, Representative Wilson. And I know Seaton is at a budget closeout session right now, and I'm not sure where the rest of them are. I think my aide is trying to round them up. But anyway, I'd like to recognize that our House Recording Secretary, Debbie, is here to assist us, and also Steve is our LIO moderator. And so if you have cell phones, please shut them off. Not just put them to vibrate, but shut them off, because they interfere with the electronics in here. And so anyway, we'd like to hear, okay, and I guess Gardner and Faircloth are in budget closeout, and Sisson and Keller have excused absences, and they're on airplanes right now. So anyway, we only have about an hour, so if you would, Mr. Jesse, if you would go ahead and introduce your program and the people that are going to be doing each individual different area, and we will listen.
Great. Well, thank you, Representative Wilson and Senator Davis, for giving us this opportunity. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and with me are Breida Bishop from the Department of Health and Social Services, and Bill Herman, Trust Program Officer. And they've actually been doing a lot of the coordination and leadership from those two agencies on this initiative, and want to have a chance for them to present some of the work they've been doing. In addition, we'll have a couple of providers that are going to be able to give you a firsthand look at what's actually been happening on the ground as a result of this initiative. I'm very proud to be able to present this to the committees. This has been, in my mind, one of the most successful collaborative efforts between the Trust and the Department of Health and Social Services. Has involved the tribal health organizations, the provider community, families, kids themselves. We've had a very broad base of involvement in developing this, and as you'll see from the data, we are, in fact, getting results. So with that, I want to go ahead and turn it over to Bill, who's going to start going through. You all have this packet in front of you, and we'll start on page 2. Bill?
Thank you, Jeff. I just wanted to kind of point out some of the history here. What has happened is over the last 10 years or so, we've seen increasingly a use of the out-of-state residential psychiatric treatment centers that we have contracts with for Medicaid services. And that was pretty much just caused by, increasingly financing our system via Medicaid and having that being directed mostly, the funding streams mostly directed towards later higher levels of care, residential care, those kinds of things. Not so much having it available for early intervention or prevention type activities that would kind of limit that, and not as much in the outpatient area as. And so what happened is the kids began moving from lower levels of care into these higher levels over time. The goals of our present initiative is to reverse that trend, to get the kids back into with their families closer to home or in their home. Much better for the kid. The recovery is much better. It prevents other kinds of decompensations and having to go back into treatment again by working at home as much as possible with the family, helping to work on the family system to make it all work better for the kid and for the parents. And it brings that money. We have about $40 million that has been spent out of state each year for these Medicaid-eligible services in out-of-state residential facilities. On slide, the page 3, which has the history of the exponential growth here, this is basically showing you graphically what's happened to the money that's been spent on residential psychiatric treatment center services, and you can see that we've pretty much held. We didn't have much increased capacity in-state, so that's pretty much been staying at the same level year after year, but you can see the red bar in the middle showing the out-of-state referrals increasing, and you can see the numbers of kids at the top of each of the red bars. So with that, I'll hand it over to Rita.
Senator Elton.
Yeah, I may not have the charts that are being referenced here.
Okay.
We're on slide.
I now have it. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for your help.
I don't think I have that one either. I have these two.
Okay, you've got the 5-year and the 3-year plan, but not the PowerPoint.
And the synopsis of those. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, that's important to know.
Proceed.
And I think for your benefit, because this has come up recently in the House and Finance Subcommittee frankly, in the House Finance Committee generally, and I had a chance to talk to Representative Wilson about it this morning. I thought I'd very briefly talk about how the trust got involved in this initiative, because I think there's some confusion in parts of the legislature about how this relationship and partnership developed. This is not an initiative created by the Mental Health Trust. As you can see from these numbers, the state was experiencing a dramatic growth on page 3 in these out-of-state placements. It was actually during the Murkowski administration when Commissioner Gilbertson and the Chief of Staff, Jim Clark, called the trustees of the Mental Health Trust Authority into the governor's conference room, identified this as a priority for that administration, and asked the Mental Health Trust if we would assist them in addressing this issue in the state. It was the result of that connection that we began first, of course, working with Health and Social Services, and then branched out and made this a focus area of the trust, that we began working in partnership to develop strategies and to invest in the infrastructure that would be necessary to carry the results of this project out. There's been discussion that somehow the trust has leveraged the state into making these investments in the in-state infrastructure. And I just want to make it clear that, in fact, it is the state which has leveraged the Mental Health Trust into investing literally millions of dollars over the last several years into developing this infrastructure in order to address these issues. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brita to talk about the slide on page 4.
Okay. And I just wanted to mention before I talk about the slides that the other documents you have are the 5-year plan and the 3-year update that we were asked to provide to the legislature. So that's what those documents are, and they have a lot more detail than what we're going to cover here today. So I get to do the fun slides, and the first one that I have is the shift in-state expenditures. And this is the first time between 06 and 07, that we actually saw the out-of-state expenditures start to come down. So the numbers of kids started coming down, I think, last year, but the expenditures followed this year. So that's what we're seeing on this slide, is a drop from $40 million to about $36,700,000. And that, then on slide 5, the next slide, you can see the drop in the utilization in out-of-state RPTC care, and you can also see the increase in the utilization in in-state RPTC care. What we've got here is the numbers that are the solid lines, the darker lines that go up to the 1033 and the 984 on the top line. Those are the actual numbers. The numbers to the right are the projections, and those came from a work group that sat down and tried to figure out what kinds of utilization do we think we should try to get to by 2013. We'd like to be able to bring the kids home by 2013 and have the funding in the budget that we need. So the right-hand side of that is a projection based on goals that the group selected.
And while you have a lull there, I just want to make a comment that Senator Cowdery is online listening. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And then if you look on page 6, in my mind, this is one of the most critical pieces of information from a legislative perspective for you to understand and to appreciate what the strategy is behind this initiative. What this shows is the relative allocation of community investment in Alaska for the continuum of care for these kids. In the yellow, the in-state residential psychiatric treatment center expenditures, and at the bottom in blue, the out-of-state residential psychiatric treatment center expenditures. What this is showing you is the reinvestment strategy that's being used in order to achieve the goals of this project. And as you can see, as over time we bring down the out-of-state expenditures, we need to reinvest those funds in in-state programs, because that's the only way that you continue this curve, is to continue to make that reinvestment. Now, the reason I want to highlight this is because one of the realities of the budget process here in the legislature is that by the nature of where these expenditures come, the finance committees see a series of increments every year for Bring the Kids Home. There's $1 million here for community outreach outreach services. You know, there's $500,000 here for individualized service money. And then the legislators start to say, well, now wait, we're just investing more and more every year in this Bring the Kids Home initiative. You know, we can't sustain this. This is a concern in the future of how we continue to spend this money for this initiative. What I want you to see from this is that, well, at the same time, what you're doing is not only containing, but you're reducing the funding that's going out of state, which had you continued the curve that we showed you back on slide 3, you can see, and I'm sure you can imagine how the blue lines of out-of-state expenditures would be looking for these years. They would be continuing to go up from the FY05 level. And I can assure you that they would have exceeded the total cost of these services over time. And I think that's critical, particularly for those of you that are on finance committees, is that you really are comfortable with this reinvestment strategy, so that when you see those increments come to finance for these community services, you understand the reinvestment strategy that's being applied to achieve this goal. It's not just simply a matter of throwing more money at the problem or the programs over time. The other point I want to try to make too is, and we've talked about this in some committees, if you were building a continuum of care for kids and families in this state from the ground floor up, you would not do it the way we have proceeded on this initiative. What you would do is you would start with home and community-based services. You would try to serve every kid and every family first in their natural environment. And only when that failed, only when you had provided all the necessary services at that level, but it still wasn't working, would you move to the next level of care. And then only after that was accomplished would you move to the next level. And so in the end is when we would be talking about both in-state and out-of-state residential psychiatric treatment centers. But we knew, and I know you recognize, that had we come forward and asked for several million dollars of increments to provide those lowest level of services in the community, with the promise that in 5 to 10 years you would recognize a reduction in out-of-state placement, we would not have been successful in getting that investment. Now, the reason that that's important for you to understand is that forced us to look at building in-state residential capacity immediately in the short term to start to keep kids from leaving the state and to return the kids that were out of state. We do not want to continue to focus on residential services. They are the most expensive level of service. They are the most disruptive of the natural family and community ties and supports that ultimately will be the most successful at keeping kids out of state services. So as you go through here and we talk about capital and other aspects, realize that we feel we're on a course now to have fully built out our residential capacity. Future investments need to be made in that home and community-based sector of the continuum of care, because in the long run, that's where we're going to be able to keep this curve turned and keep these kids out of residential care.
Okay, and on slide 7, this is a list of the general progress indicators that we're maintaining for Bring the Kids Home, and it also identifies some of the things that we just saw on the slides, which is some of the progress. So a decrease in admissions to out-of-state RPTC care. We're keeping information both on admissions and on the number served in out-of-state care. Admissions are the number that are admitted during the fiscal year. Number served could include kids that were admitted in a previous year. So those are two ways of tracking. Shows the increase of in-state RPTC admissions, decrease in out-of-state RPTC. And then I won't read through them all, but you can see that there's some progress in a number of places, including a funding shift this year. Other indicators that we're keeping, we also have a new Bring the Kids Home grant program that's been going on for the last 3 years. And for each of the grants that we fund, we have an individual set of indicators that we're maintaining, and then also some general indicators that the Division of Behavioral Health maintains. And for the same thing, we established an individualized service agreement funding pool, and we maintain indicators and information on how that money is utilized and the impact of that. So we have a number of different places we're tracking our outcomes. If you look at slide number 8, these are two indicators that DBH is maintaining for all of their service. These indicators are currently only for grantees and only for community-based services. During 08 and 09, we're going to be expanding, DBH is going to be expanding this to include residential psychiatric treatment center services as well, so we'll get this information there. We're trying to do two things with these. One is we'd like to improve our outcomes, and the other thing is we want to make sure that as we serve kids in-state, we don't see a decline in these numbers, that they don't go downhill.
And the thing I'd like to point out about the indicators that we've just talked about is that this is a core part of the strategy of implementing this program, to identify key hard data points, which Bill, for example, calls our dashboard. This is just like flying a plane or driving a car. You have a dashboard of indicators that you're watching all the time. And if you're investing in a particular strategy and you're not getting the results that you expected to get, then you start asking questions like, why is it not working like it was supposed to? How do we need to change our approach, change our strategies in order to get to the results that we intended to achieve? So it's a very, in my opinion, highly sophisticated, focused, and measurable strategy to achieve these results. And so we will be watching all of these indicators for many years to come, so that not only are we able to be successful in achieving the goals of this project, but we will be able to maintain that success over time. And just to digress, you know, we did this once before. Several years ago, we had many kids out of state, fewer than we have now, and we created the Alaska Youth Initiative. And that provided wraparound services to kids and families in the community. It was a good strategy then. It's a good strategy now. Well, what happened? Well, we didn't continue to pay attention to the dashboard. In fact, we didn't even have a dashboard. And as a result, that program got out of control, was not managed well, ended up being too expensive and too inefficient, and it was dismantled by the legislature. Now we're in the process, basically, of having to recreate those individualized services for individual families and kids in the community, except that this time we will leave those indicators in place and continue to monitor the health of this continuum of care over time, so that we're not back here in 15 years with the same problem trying to create the same solution. If you look at page 9, This will show you the FY09 projects and funding that you'll see in the budget when it comes through the finance committees and ultimately onto the floor. And again, I'll reiterate that the purpose of the trust funding in this matrix is to accelerate the capacity of the community to expand so that you're able to make that reinvestment of out-of-state resources. For those of you that have been here some length of time, you probably remember Harborview. Harborview was a facility in Valdez, an institutional setting, that when the trust was created, we knew that we could do better and more cost-effectively serve those people in the community. The problem was that the legislature was never willing to fund the community programs at the same time they had to continue to fund the institution. With the trust's financial help in running the institution, you were able to reinvest the funds that had been going to Harborview in the community. The purpose of the trust funding in this initiative is similar. While we contribute millions of dollars over several years to build capacity in the community, that will start to bring down the number of kids out of state. It will reduce your financial, has in fact reduced your financial obligation to the out-of-state placement. That allows you to reinvest in the community services. So again, that's the role of the trust funding in this matrix. If you want to turn to page 10, one of the things that we were asked to do as part of this initiative is to develop a five-year plan so that you could see what the long-term strategy was, both in terms of funding and in terms of strategies. So I'm not going to read through here. You can see here what the six primary strategies are in the five-year plan. And again, the idea is continue to develop the in-state capacity. I want to particularly call your attention to item six, which is developing strategies for a skilled behavioral workforce. This is really a challenge across the entire behavioral health system, not just in this area. If we don't have a skilled, reliable workforce, all the reinvestment in the world isn't going to deliver more or better services to the community. If you turn to page 11.
If you would just give me a second here, just let the record show that Representative Gardner has joined us.
And then does Representative Gardner have a copy of the PowerPoint? And we're on slide 11.
Thank you. Hey, thank you. Go on.
On slide 11, there was a fair amount of controversy within the work group over whether we should show you these numbers. Because as you see, the general fund mental health projected funding is in excess of $20 million over 5 years. And that's a significant amount of resource. Again, I want to draw your attention back to the slide on page 6, where again you can see the strategy that's being employed here. Yes, this is a very significant investment in these services. But number one, it's necessary to serve these kids and families in the community. And number two, it's part of the overall reinvestment strategy. And if you go back to slide 6, you'll see that we do project that the overall expenditures will remain relatively stable over the next five-year period. This is what Representative Hawker calls the truth in budgeting approach. We're not making any bones about it. If you want to continue with this initiative and to continue to achieve the results that we've set out, then this is the long-term commitment that you're looking at making. If at any time the legislature or the administration decide that they no longer want to make this level of commitment to this initiative, certainly you're entitled to do so. You can stop making these reinvestments into the community, but I will guarantee you that you will see that out-of-state curve return to the path that it was on before we started this initiative. If you look on page 12, again, you'll see some additional components of the five-year plan. workforce development, and capital development. Just very briefly on the capital development, and I think you'll hear this from some of our providers, the state has been very fortunate in that we've had some very strong partners in the capital part of the Bring the Kids Home initiative. The Denali Commission has contributed over $6 million so far in capital funding. And in fact, when you look at the South Central Foundation project, where they are building a 44-bed in-state residential psychiatric treatment facility in Aklutna, which, by the way, will be operated with 100% federal reimbursement for services, and that's a huge savings to the state. That facility is going to have nearly $11 million in Denali Commission funding. South Central Foundation itself is putting up over $9 million. All of that is matching a little over $9 million of state funding. So again, this is a broad-based partnership putting tremendous resources into developing this continuum of care. And now what I'd like to do is bring up a couple of providers and have the chance for you to meet them and listen to what they've been accomplishing as well.
May I ask a quick question? The 45-bed residential facility, is that for adults, all ages? Will it include teens?
It's for adolescents.
Adolescents.
This is not for adults.
Exclusively. Okay, thank you.
And Senator Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. the thing that I'm having a little difficulty following is we have nice charts on the utilization. I certainly agree with bringing the kids home, but when we talk about the investment, I understand the investment needs to be made here to accomplish that, but I don't see a chart that actually shows even the anticipated or the expected overall expense and how at some point in the future that flattens out. Obviously, there's inflation and that, so if you could direct me back to where you were referring to how that operates.
Well, Senator Thomas, through the chair, if you'll go back to slide 6. Where we show the allocation of resources between out-of-state RPTC in blue, in-state RPTC in red, and community investment in yellow, you'll see at the bottom there's a row of numbers under the fiscal year. That's our projected total cost of the initiative.
Follow-up, Senator Thomas?
You're anticipating that by fiscal year 13, you will be back to expenditures that are less than fiscal year 06 and almost approaching what it was in 05.
That's the current projection. Now, you know as well as I do that the farther out you go, the less certain these results are going to be in terms of specific numbers. You mentioned inflation. There's certainly, we're undergoing right now a rate adjustment process. That no doubt is going to have some impact on these numbers. But actually, I wish that we had shown you the total numbers for FY 2000 through 2004, which you would have seen the dramatic increase in total costs. I believe if you went back to 2000, you'd probably be looking at somewhere in the $15 to $20 million range, and we were soaring past 40. When we got up to FY04. So in my mind, if we can just hold the line on total investment, it would be a tremendous victory. We have never sold this initiative on the basis that you are going to save money. This is not an initiative designed to save money. It is designed to change where you invest your money and what you're investing your money in.
And I certainly agree with that. Thanks for clarifying that to me a little bit, because I was looking at that as more of a chart indicating where the investments are made, rather than potential flattening out of the curve, which I agree with. And I do agree that spending your money in states a lot better. You're putting people to work here. It builds the economy rather than just sending it outside. So, thank you.
Representative Gardner.
On that point, would you tell me, please, it's also designed to change outcomes?
Oh, absolutely, Representative
Gardner. Okay. Not just about investments.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I look at when you said it wasn't designed to save money, in my mind, I said, but it's designed to save kids. That's kind of what I was thinking about it. Go ahead.
With that, I'd like to have Karen Schaff introduce herself and talk about the program at Volunteers of America.
I'm Karen Schaff. I'm from Volunteers of America. And I can talk about the outcome piece. We have two projects that are involved in the Bring the Kids Home effort that I'm excited to be able to talk about. The first one is the Assertive Continuing Care program. And if you look at page 14 in your handout, you'll be able to follow that. This is an evidence-based practice that's designed to serve kids with substance use disorders and severe emotional disturbances that are coming out of residential psychiatric treatment centers, coming out of in-state residential centers, coming out of institutions such as McLaughlin Youth Center and other outpatient programs. We have served to date, started in 2006, and we have served 121 kids to date. So, and there's some data that that I'd like to share that is particularly FY07 data. The model itself, when the kids come out of these services, they're a little saturated. They don't really want to come back into clinics and come back into buildings. So we actually go to them. So we go to them in their homes. We go to them in their schools. We meet them in coffee shops if that's where they want to meet us. Anything to increase that contact and continue to do that skill development and to continue to reinforce the stuff that they've learned in these centers. The goal, obviously, is to keep them in their community and maintain the outcomes that we're all working for. In FY07, we saw a 37% increase in retention rate from our continuing care model that we had prior to this implementation. This is very significant. It reflects the data from the original research that this model was based on. So it's kind of nice to know that model fidelity is really important. And two, it has a direct correlation with the length of stay a client or a youth spends in services directly correlates to their relapse rate. So the longer they're in the treatment, the less likely they are to relapse, and that also correlates to remaining in schools, staying at a lower level of care, not reentering psychiatric centers or other residential centers, having decreased legal involvement. Also, if you look, 90% of the youth served, which is 48 youth out of 52 youth in fiscal year 07, were diverted from a secure residential center, and that's your psychiatric treatment center and McLaughlin Youth Center. This project has also started out working with McLaughlin Youth Center's transitional services and has developed into a partnership in which we are actually in their facility seeing all of their youth coming out of institutionalization with substance use disorders. And that's just emerging. So right now we're seeing all of their youth. We start a month prior to their discharge, and then we continue to serve them once they've come out, and we're part of their continuum of care, which is very exciting, and we're seeing really good results with that.
Karen.
Yes.
When you say you start a month before they're released, how many times do you see them during that month?
Four times, approximately. Yeah. We actually have started having them transported while they're still in institutional care to our groups as well. So they're actually starting to integrate with other youth in the community who have had like experiences. And that seems to be successful as well.
Okay.
So they're already kind of used to the environment and the setting before they're released.
Okay. Thank you.
If you look at page 15, I'll talk about our residential facility, which is called the ARCH program. This is an expansion and replacement project. The picture you're looking at right now is the picture of our current building, which is right on the road and very inadequate in terms of size. It was been operating since 1981. We house 16 youth, and the facility is deteriorating rapidly and is in need of replacement. So if you turn to page 16.
Excuse me, Karen, where is this at?
Highland Road, right out of Anchorage.
Oh, okay. Highland Road.
Anchorage. I'm sorry, right before Eagle River outside of Anchorage, okay. Yeah. If you look at page 16, you'll see that we've actually started building this new facility. We're expanding from a 16-bed facility to a 24-bed facility. The target population, again, is youth with substance use disorders and severe emotional disturbances. It's actually a service gap. The kids that we are talking to that are coming from out-of-state psychiatric facilities are telling us that their substance use issues are not getting adequately addressed, which is why we're seeing them kind of reappear in the system. This facility also will work with kids with co-occurring disorders and will expand our psychiatric services. So we'll be adding mental health counselors, adding psychiatrists, and changing some of our program to reflect the client's needs.
Karen, I'm sorry, I've got so many questions, but this is kind of like a halfway house then?
No, it is actually a residential treatment center.
So they don't go anywhere else. This is where they go to begin with. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So they'll be residing in this facility.
Now, when you go, it seems to me that when if they're released and they're put into the same environment again with around the same people, that would be very, very difficult to, mm-hmm. because of peer pressure and everything else, to stay straight. And so what kind of a situation do they go back into when they're released?
Well, one of the things that we have integrated into our services is family therapy, so we and a family program. So we work with the family all along, and we work with the community so that those issues are addressed prior to them being released. I'd probably say 80% of the youth in our care are from rural areas as well. And so we certainly work in those with those communities to establish the supports and work with the families. One of the things we do is we send the kids home for what we call a transition pass. So they get to actually go back for a week prior to them being discharged and practice what they've learned, get to experience things, set up continuing care, set up school, their school system, and then come back and work on the issues that they kind of ran into when they were there. The project is obviously, you can tell from the pictures, in construction, and it has a completion date of June 30th of 08. Page 17 shows the partners in this project. And Jeff, did you have something you wanted to comment on?
I will just mention that, again, I talked earlier about the assistance the state's getting in developing the infrastructure around this initiative. And I think you can all see from this that the state's contribution to this project is about $1.2 million. And yet the total project is in excess of $6 million. So we are highly leveraged in terms of state dollars invested. And the reason I bring this up is, although we are not requesting any additional capital state match in the FY09 budget, we probably will come back with a capital budget increment in the FY10 budget. But I just wanted you to see how highly leveraged the capital development in this area is. Any more questions for Karen? We'll go on to Dee Foster and let her introduce herself and tell you about her program.
Thank you for your time this afternoon. We really appreciate it. I'm Dee Foster, Director of Child and Family Services for Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. We serve about 700 seriously emotionally disturbed children a year through several programs. And probably 80% of those children arrive on our doorstep because of multiple trauma, most specifically child abuse and neglect. We see actually a very small percentage of neurobiological disorders. We're also the only site, we're one of 50 sites nationally of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And we have developed the Alaska Child Trauma Center. By these means, we access national expert information, and we have implemented 5 evidence-based practices. So on page 19, what I did was we've received 30 months of Bring the Kids Home funding. That's about $256,000. And I calculated that cost with the number of children served. I skipped a slide. I'm sorry. Page 18. So analyzing 30 months of Bring the Kids Home funding, we've seen 107 kiddos. We served 24, returning them from out-of-state care, 24 from more restrictive in-state care, 59% we prevented from admission to residential treatment centers, 65% successfully completed treatment, and just briefly the outcomes that we looked for, symptom reduction, skills acquisition for the child and parent and family, community integration, family preservation, family reunification, and placement stabilization. So if we had kiddos that were successfully adopted, we considered that a great success because they finally had a home.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Under successfully completed treatment, how long is the follow-up? I mean, is this 65% a month later, a year later, 3 years later? Do we have any idea?
At this point, we're just developing that follow-up procedure. It's now we have a number of interns who can actually follow that along. Our staff has been limited. We have these kids and their families in treatment anywhere from 9 to 12 months, so we do spend quite a period of time with them. And, of course, our emphasis is on changing the family and changing the environment and changing the system. We don't believe that you send a child away to be fixed.
Follow-up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So the figure 65% successfully completed treatment, that means discharged having completed all the recommendations of the protocol or the plan.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Now, I do want to follow up with that, Dee. So the other 35%, do they just went back into treatment then, or?
No, the largest percentage of those were families which we could not engage with all of our efforts, who did not follow through with treatment for their family and child.
So, but did, because the family wasn't able to, for whatever reason, follow up, does the child then, I mean, what happens to the child? Do they go end up in treatment again, or where are they?
Well, in this 107 sample, 3% were returned to out-of-state care against our recommendations, and about 3% went back with our support because they needed that level of treatment for safety.
Okay.
And 30%.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I'm kind of struggling with this, too. I mean, how many of these decisions are made by the family, and how many of these decisions are made by the state? I mean, are your clients, or are the 107 that are being treated, are they all, are they all wards of the state?
No, it's a mixture.
Okay. So what is the mix?
Probably 50-50.
Okay. And if I could follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Elton.
So decisions are being made on behalf of about half of your children or adolescents. Those decisions are being made by the state, and then on the other half, the decisions are being made by families then, or surrogates of the family?
Even when children are in state's custody, it's a joint effort with the family.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I guess I want to follow up a little bit on this, too. I'm just thinking of a scenario that might be that you're trying to get the family to help, but maybe they're have got an alcohol problem and just can't follow up because of their own problems in the situation.
Yes, and we try every bit, exercise every bit of our skills to try and engage the parent in their own individual treatment or going to substance abuse treatment. Or whatever we can pull out of our hat box. You know, sometimes it means bringing the family in, saying we're helping your child and we want to help you help your child so it's not so threatening. And then further down the road when they trust us more, we can make some of those heavy-duty recommendations for them to look at their own impairment.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate your page 19 chart. That puts it in a better perspective, I think, as far as the money end of it, where you're showing what's happening on a daily, monthly, and annual basis for treatment. The other one, other charts mix in all of the facilities and that type of thing, and it makes it, this one at least can give you that per capita cost change, which I think is important for people to recognize if they're looking at whether we call it money savings or whatever we struggle to call it.
Right. Thank you, sir. And I do want to say that this is combined for these 107 children, bring the kids home funding, and what it costs Medicaid. So for each kid, only $80 a month from bring the kids home funding. And the remainder of this $1,322 a month is Medicaid cost.
And I don't know if that could be, something that we concentrate on a little bit more, even adding the facilities that are being built in, because that would show a dropping off of at least the expense per child or something. So I think that would be helpful to me anyhow if it was done on a broader basis than maybe everybody does it but doesn't pass it along and it doesn't become a statistic in handouts like this or when we're talking before committees. But that's helpful for me. Thank you.
And I'd just like to close by saying I'm a child therapist by trade, and I absolutely am shocked that a child with attachment disorder would be sent away from their family and community 2,000 miles to a facility where they were cared for by paid caregivers in three shifts. It's not the appropriate treatment.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, I'd like to applaud you for that, and I've said it before in this committee. I'll say it again. As a CASA volunteer, I had a child assigned to my caseload who, as a six-year-old, had been sent to a residential treatment facility out of state where he languished for 8 years and had, without seeing a single member of his family. He was a village kid, a native kid who'd never been camping, never been fishing, and that is just completely unconscionable.
A waste of human potential.
Yes.
It's inhumane.
And now I'd like to let Walter Majoros talk about the Juno Youth Services Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or I should say Madam's Chair, plural. Committee members, my name is Walter Majoros. I am the Executive Director of Juno Youth Services, and I wanted to talk to you about two programs and facilities that we have developed under the Bring the Kids Home Initiative, and one of them is a residential treatment program called the Montana Creek Residential Program, and the other is actually an apartment, and it's called the Black Bear Transitional Living Apartments. And actually, if you wanted to see either or both of these facilities, we're going to be hosting a tour at 4:30 today. We'll be leaving from the Gold Belt, and if any of you are interested, Gold Belt Hotel, that is, and we're going to be bringing a group of people out there to tour the facilities. I'd like to start by talking about the Montana Creek Residential Program. And this program actually opened up in August of last year, and Senator Elton was one of our honored guest speakers to open the facility. And if you turn to the slide, you can see on page 21, it's a gorgeous facility. It is 15 beds. One of the things that it has that is wonderful is it actually has a gymnasium. Prior to this building, we used to have to bring our residential kids a half hour to 45 minutes on a bus to even get to a gymnasium that they could use. So it really has been, tremendous to have that resource on site. If you turn to the next page, on page 22, I wanted to talk about some of the features of the program. As I say, it is 15 beds. It's designed specifically for kids that have both mental health and chemical dependency problems. We call that co-occurring disorders. It's extremely common. It's not the exception. It's more the rule that kids have both mental health and chemical dependency problems at the same time. It's also a co-ed facility. The ages are 12 to 18. It's about, I think, over time been running about 50% Juno and about 50% from outside the community, other communities in Southeast Alaska, and also from communities up north as well. In terms of the capital part of the project, we did have multiple capital funding partners, and ironically, you know, in terms of the capital funds, there really wasn't a penny of state funding that went into this facility. It was about $1.5 million of Denali Commission. It was special needs funding that went through the state, but it was actually trust authority funds, about $500,000, $300,000 from Rasmussen Foundation, and our own agency put in about, you know, $700,000. I mean, it eroded a lot of our savings in terms of both cash and land for the program. One of the things that it's extremely unique about this program is it is a partnership with the Native Health Corporation, and this is something that the state really wanted us to pursue. I guess my point here is that this is a great deal for the state, you know, and because this really saves state general funds, and so we worked with Search to be able to construct the partnership, and it was very complex to be able to do this in working with existing federal laws to allow for this facility to get 100% reimbursement from federal Medicaid for Native kids, and we had to do some complex things, such as Search being the provider of record. Search contracts with our agency, Juvenile Youth Services, to be able to operate the program. Search leases the facility from us because one of the criteria is that the Native Corporation has to have ownership interest in the facility, and we also act as the billing agent for Search. So it has been quite complex, but also quite successful. About two-thirds of the clients have been Native clients to date, and when you run the numbers in terms of, you know, how much of a Medicaid dollar is state funds and how much is federal funds, for every Native child that is in that facility for a year period of time saves the state approximately $64,000. And so for the year that we're currently in, we're going to save the state, or we are saving the state, about $500,000 in general funds.
Senator,
yeah, because I have a constituent testifying, I want to offer an apology to the committee and to the presenters. We're being my other two colleagues. We have a bill up in our Senate S committee, and I just want to say thank you to all. I know more about Walter's program than I do about Karen Adiz, but I suspect that in those communities too, we sometimes like to point out in our communities programs that work. And some people may misunderstand us and think they work because of us, but they work because of the service providers. And I just want to thank them for what they're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Galt. The second facility that I wanted to talk about is starts on slide 23, and it's also on the same property as the Montana Creek residential program, and this is called the Black Bear Transitional Living Program Apartments. This just opened up within like the last month, and if you you can see what the exterior of the building looks like, and one of the kitchen units. And if you turn to the slide on the next page, on page 24, this is a 13-bed, it's an apartment building. It's not a residential treatment program. It's an apartment building for kids 18 to 21. And there are kids that are coming out of our residential programs, kids that are coming out of the foster care system, kids that are coming out of the juvenile justice system. And we have a huge homeless youth problem in Juneau, so a lot of them are also runaway and homeless youth. And the program does include a resident case manager, and this is not just a property manager. This is somebody who actually provides services to these kids, because almost all of them have serious behavioral health problems. It was a capital funding partnership. Denali Commission contributed close to $800,000, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation over $700,000, and our agency about another $200,000. You know, the similarities in these two programs, you know, are they both were excellent funding partnerships. They're both meeting important unmet needs, and they're both bringing kids home and keeping kids home. And I guess the last point that I'd like to make is that while I think bringing the kids home has been, you know, very successful on sort of the building the facilities and getting the residential services in a state, I don't believe it has been very successful in creating the community-based services. And up to this point, we haven't made that reinvestment. Our agency has tried to do that in a couple different areas, but like this transitional living home that I was just describing, there really aren't any operating funds for that. The way that we're doing it is we are fortunate to have a federal grant There is no state funding essentially that goes to that program. We have a couple other Bring the Kids Home projects, again, in community-based services. One of them is we serve the other end of the continuum, the kids, the 3 to 5 year olds that are also already developing, you know, serious, you know, emotional and behavioral problems. And so we provide services in the Head Start centers. We lose over $100,000 a year in that program, you know, because again, the community reinvestment is there. There's only so long that we can do that before we just have to drop the program. One last example is because, you know, a lot of kids go out to services and come back from services, we decided that we needed, and sometimes, most times, they don't even go through our agency. There is between a private psychiatrist and a parent are making that decision. But our agency is the one who has to provide the services when they come back. So we decided that we needed to create a transitional case manager position to track those kids. Now, again, there's no state funding for that position. So we have reinvested in our agency. We have invested like about $1.2 million over the last couple of years. But we can't do that any longer. Our savings are gone. And so if you truly want to see the kids served in Alaska in community-based services, it's absolutely critical that the state invests in those services.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner?
I always have a question, at least one. Speaking about the need and capacity, do you have empty beds ever in either of these facilities? What kind of wait lists do you have?
Right. You know, in our agency, this is a great question. Our agency always has a wait list for services. We have, at any given time, we have 100 kids on a wait list for services, 50 that are waiting to get into any services at all, and 50 that are in a service but not in their preferred service. So we average 100 kids on a wait list at any given time. And that's not just residential services. That is community-based services as well. Our utilization for our residential programs average between 95 and 100% consistently over the years.
Thank you.
Does the City of Juneau put funds into this?
We get some small grants from the City of Juneau, but, you know, particularly if the revenue sharing goes anywhere this year, I do plan to do some advocacy at the city level to look at getting a larger contribution from the municipality.
And I just might add that Walter talked about the early childhood program that he's running. That might ring a bell for you. That was one of the general fund increments that was rejected by the Health and Social Services Finance Subcommittee this morning. And that concludes our presentation, and we'll take any questions.
Representative
Gardner? I just say it's sort of a mix of good news and bad news, isn't it?
We're getting there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for all that you are doing. It's a very frustrating thing, and I'm looking at this, and one is a 15-bed and one's a 13-bed, and that's 28 kids altogether, and that's just a drop in the bucket. And you think, oh, so much effort is going into it to help these kids, and the numbers are so amazing. Are you finding that the home life of children is getting better, staying the same, getting worse?
Well, I think we've had fairly good success in getting the families engaged in services. And the thing that we're fortunate about at Juneau Youth Services is we're able to offer a pretty full array of services. So we have the residential care, but we also have programs in the schools, and we have outpatient services, and we have community-based care and home-based services. And so it's a little bit easier for us to keep the families engaged because we can meet their needs as they move along the continuum.
I guess what I meant was you didn't answer my question because I didn't state it very well. Not the people that you serve so much, but overall out there, all the families as a whole, are families doing better overall than they used to, or is it staying about the same, or are things getting worse?
That's a hard question. You know, in my humble opinion, I think it's harder for kids and families these days than it ever has been before.
Okay.
And we're seeing more severe problems, and we've had, you know, 4 or 5 youth suicides in Juneau within the last year, you know, adolescent suicides. I think it's very hard for youth and families now.
Dean, Kara, do either of you have a perspective on that?
I think if you just look at the normal population, that parents are having to both parents work to support a household. There's a lot of stress. It's a fast-paced world. I think I can certainly say there's much more stress for families than there was 20 years ago.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Wilson, we do have a number of families here that have been working in this area. I know we tried to stay to our time frame, but if the committee would like, we certainly have people that could talk to you directly about these issues.
I might hang around for a little bit.
Very good. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, and we've stayed on our timetable, and we appreciate all of you for coming, and I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you very much.